Jennifer Harbury, is a heroic fighter for human rights, and she is a graduate of Harvard Law School. She was working in Guatemala investigating the human rights abuses that the Indian population was suffering. And while she was there, she met her future husband. He was a Mayan Indian guerrilla leader, and they married in 1990. In 1992, he disappeared. He was captured by the military and tortured and killed. And in her quest to find out what happened to him, Jennifer discovered that the CIA was involved. And that set her on a course of tireless hard work to find out what's really happening in Central America, not just to her husband, but to all the other people, thousands of them, who died. And she participated in three fasts. One of them was more than a month long, both in front of the White House and in Guatemala. She wrote a book about that, Looking for Everardo. And recently, she wrote another book about her work that she's doing now. She's in charge of the Stop Torture campaign of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. Please welcome Jennifer Harbury.
Very glad to be here tonight. I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about the long-term history, the lengthy history that the United States has in terms of sponsoring torture throughout the world. This is not a new thing that we're looking at since the photographs were released at Abu Ghraib. It's a phenomenon and a practice that goes way, way back. I was very pleased at the national reaction, the public reaction in this country, when those photographs from Abu Ghraib were released. What I was hearing was pretty unanimous outrage from all sectors of society, not just from the human rights supporters and organizations, but from the different church networks, people in the Midwest, farmers, farm workers, busboys, literally busboys, poets, you name it. I was hearing the same reaction. And that's as it should be, because since the founding of this country, since the colonists wrote up the Constitution, in other words, the concept of torture has been absolutely abhorrent here. Patrick Henry himself pointed out that when the colonists came to this country from Europe, they were literally fleeing an era of the rack, the screw, and the star chamber. And that if, quote, those barbaric practices are allowed here, then we are lost and undone, unquote. The whole idea was that those practices would never be allowed into this country. Those have always been our ideals. Needless to say, we have often fallen short. Slavery, the Trail of Tears, the Abner Louima case would be but a few examples. But those are our ideals. Suddenly, with the horrors that we saw on September 11th in New York City, we're being told by our government, though, that we have to allow torture. We have to legalize it, in so many words. We have to use it in order to stay safe. And we're seeing that again and again, even after the release of those photographs. In fact, we're hearing three levels of claims or defenses by our government to somehow justify the use of torture. The first is that it's not really a government practice. It's just a few soldiers that got out of control, a few bad apples, a few operators that somehow weren't following orders. We've heard often enough it was just Lindy England and a few people that kind of got into this animal house mentality at the prison. Maybe a few people in Afghanistan got out of control, but it's not a policy. Why do our government officials keep insisting that it was just individual cases and not a policy or practice? Because if it's a policy or practice, then not only must Lindy England go to prison, but so must higher level of people or officials who authorized it, like Donald Rumsfeld, for example. I mean, the responsibility legally goes all the way to the top if, in fact, it's a policy or orders that were being followed. The second claim we keep hearing, though, is that whether it was a policy or whether or not it was individual soldiers, it was somehow legal because they're enemy combatants, they're not covered by the Geneva Conventions. And I'd like to get back to that in a moment. And the third argument is, even if it was totally illegal, then somehow you still have to allow it because there's no other way for us to keep you safe. You have to look the other way while we carry out literally the crimes of torture abroad with regards to the detainees. Or you're going to be in the next World Trade Center that goes down. Looking at those arguments one by one, I'd like to first look at the claim that these are just a few bad apples. I think that that's been put to rest. We now have government files that have been declassified thanks to the ACLU about the Guantanamo prisoners. We have all kinds of information about not only tortures, et cetera, but also even murders that have taken place throughout U.S. holdings in Afghanistan and Iraq, and all of the kinds of treatment, all of the kinds of torture techniques that we saw in those photographs are uniform. They've happened all throughout the different U.S. facilities holding detainees at this time, slamming people headfirst into walls, terrifying them with dogs, the practice of waterboarding, which the CIA uses very sanitized language. They say it's a matter of holding the prisoner's head underwater until, quote, he thinks he is going to drown, unquote. Sounds kind of like a pool dunking. But in fact, if you ask any of my Central American friends, it's a matter of holding the person underwater until they do drown. They go into convulsions and lose consciousness and have to be revived through the use of CPR, and then they can be drowned again. It's definitely a torture practice. Hanging people from their arms and legs until their limbs turn black, giving them electrical shocks and cigarette burns, holding them in long-term isolation, putting them repeatedly, using combinations like we saw in the Guantanamo files where the prisoners are shackled to the floor by their hands and feet tied together, stripped naked, denied toilet privileges, food, etc., for 24 hours while strobe lights flash brilliant lights into their eyes and there's loud music throughout the 24-hour period. The FBI went in and found prisoners lying in their own excrement, and in fact, one prisoner had torn all of the hair out of his head. That exact combination of practices, in fact, had earlier been declared a matter of torture when used in combination by the United Nations in a case about Israeli treatment of Palestinian prisoners. There's no question but that that is illegal treatment. We're also seeing reports on water pits, prisoners held in water so deep they have to stand on tiptoe so that they won't drown, hideous psychological torture, threats against their children, and so on and so forth. Denial of medical care. We know that a prisoner named Zubaid was captured very early on, and Dana Priest quoted a high-level official as saying, yes, he took a bullet to the groin, but we're denying him painkillers at this time because, quote, pain is a very subjective thing, unquote. John Lind had a bullet in his leg that remained untreated for several days while he was interrogated aboard a ship without an attorney. People are held in small shipping containers made out of metal in high temperatures so that they're literally baking. There's been long-term sleep deprivation. Again, the uses of temperatures going sky high and then dropping very low in rapid alternation. They're very uniform techniques, and they're very, in a way, bizarre techniques, very, very different techniques, but they all match all the way across those facilities. So it certainly is a matter of ordering those types of techniques to be used in the current war against terror. But what I've outlined in my book and what I'd like to stress tonight is that those techniques didn't just happen since September 11th. They've been going on for decades, and they've been refined and experimented with for many decades by the CIA themselves. That's where all of these practices did, in fact, originate. If we look back over a number of cases from Central America and Latin America, what we see is those exact techniques repeated again and again and again, except that in 20 or 23 of the cases that I've been able to investigate over the last 10 years, we see that not only were the exact same techniques used, but there were, in fact, U.S. intelligence agents present in the cells. Sometimes they were just standing there asking a few questions or requesting photographs. Sometimes they actually interrogated the prisoner themselves. In a few cases, they actually were supervising the torture. But it goes back from literally just their last few years in Central America, but all the way back into the 60s, and then even farther back into Vietnam. The cold room was used on Vietnamese prisoners. The death squad sort of operations we had with Operation Phoenix have now been converted into Operation Scorpio in Iraq. General Mohush was tortured by a Scorpio unit in Iraq with a CIA person present, and he was killed. He was beaten until his ribs broke, then stuffed headfirst into a blanket roll with people crouching on his chest and rolled back and forth. Needless to say, he couldn't breathe and died. But there's an exact replica of the Operation Phoenix things that we were doing in Vietnam so many years ago. Certainly, the use of torture by proxy, as we're calling it now, where we send a prisoner to Egypt or Syria to be interrogated, and we actually fly the person over there, pay their transport, present a list of questions, and continue funding to those foreign intelligence operations. We send them to countries where they know they will be tortured. That concept of torture by proxy was obvious in my husband's case. Most of you will probably remember back in the 90s that he was, in fact, captured alive by the Guatemalan military. He was severely tortured for 2.5 years with military physicians present. He was injected with a toxic substance that caused his body to swell grotesquely and swell to the point that one arm and leg hemorrhaged. He tried so many times to escape, almost successfully, that he was held in a full body cast and was eventually either thrown out of a helicopter or dismembered and scattered across a sugarcane field so that I would not be able to identify his remains. After my third hunger strike, it was disclosed by Senator Torricelli on the Intelligence Committee that he, in fact, had been killed and also tortured all that time by Guatemalan military intelligence officials who were also on CIA payroll as paid informants. So when they were going back and forth torturing my husband, they would then go to the CIA, present the information, and receive enormous amounts of money. Colonel Alpirez, who was in charge of that particularly grim torture session with the tank of toxic gas, got $44,000 from the CIA that same month. Agents literally drove the sum of money way out into a remote jungle area base where Alpirez was at the time to make sure that he got it in time. We weren't just doing it by proxy, though. As I say, I'm sure many of you will remember the case of Sister Diana Ortiz, the American nun who was severely tortured in Guatemala and was left, for example, with 111 cigarette burns on her back and was gang-raped. And at the end of the day, a tall, obviously American man came in speaking faulty Spanish with a heavy American accent and said, "Are you crazy? She's a U.S. citizen. You have to give her back to me. It's all over the radio already." And they said, "Yes, boss," and handed her over. She later went to the embassy and begged them to send that same man back to rescue everybody else in that facility because there were so many other people, including children, who were being tortured in there. And she was smeared for the next 10 years as being mentally unstable on the grounds that no such American could possibly exist. However, we did find a photograph years later that very closely matches the police artist's sketch that had been done years before. If you look at the types of torture techniques in my husband's case and also Diana's case and the many other cases that I've uncovered since then, the 23 cases where North Americans were in fact present, there's a really startling similarity of the techniques. The water pit they're using in Afghanistan or trying to use, where people have to stand on tiptoe not to drown, there's a 1994 bulletin by the CIA in my husband's files that describes the Guatemala military base in Retaluleo, where they held prisoners in pits of water so deep they had to hang on to overhead bars to keep from drowning. Sister Diana Ortiz was attacked by dogs. So was Inez Murillo in Honduras. They were both filmed constantly and threatened all the time that if they ever spoke later or if they ever tried to complain, that of course those films would be released. And they said the mental pressure of that was terrible. They all had constant threats against their friends and family members. Inez Murillo was also subjected to the extreme temperature rise and fall. She also had ice water thrown in her face every 10 minutes throughout the night so that she would not be able to sleep. She also remembers uncomfortable positions, stress and duress. For example, her arms and legs tied together at the ankles, and then she was hung from a hook in the ceiling, not so dissimilar to what we're doing now. And I asked her how uncomfortable that was, and she said, "Well, my shoulder's dislocated." She's to this day has very serious tendon problems in her joints. I asked others about what kinds of waterboarding effects they had or treatment they'd had, and almost all people who have survived torture in Central and Latin America, including these 23 cases, they've all had their heads held underwater until they went into convulsions, including Inez Murillo in Honduras. That was by Battalion 316 members, and in fact, the CIA in secret testimony back then to the Senate Intelligence Committee admitted that there was a North American CIA agent going in and out of her cell, collecting information, bringing it back, not telling the courts and not telling her family and not telling the police where she was being illegally detained. We have other cases throughout Latin America where other similar techniques were used, all of them very recognizable. The one that I would like to just share with you, though, that is about mental torture, I think is especially important, and that's out of El Salvador, where a young physician was picked up after he'd been shot through the shoulder because he was in an area where there was a shootout between the guerrillas and the government forces, the FMLN and the government forces. Instead of being treated, he was taken to a torture center and tortured for quite some time, often with a North American there that was going in and out of the different cells throughout the period he was detained. He, too, was denied medical care and treatment of his shoulder wound. When they finally decided they couldn't get him to talk any other way because he didn't know anything, they laid him in a coffin, pulled the maggots out of his shoulder wound and put them on his chest and said, "Eat the maggots or we'll beat you." He tried very hard to lift his chin up and reach his chest, but he couldn't reach, so they literally were kicking him in the back of the head, trying to force his head up farther, even though he was tied. And all he could remember was the North American standing there laughing and saying, "Kick him again, kick him again." All right, that's the price. That's the price of the policies. That's the human price of the policies of torture that we're looking at. Is it illegal? We keep hearing that it's different now because the detainees in the war against terror are enemy combatants, and that somehow means they're not protected by the Geneva Conventions. Well, it's true that the Third Geneva Convention prohibits the torture of any prisoner of war. A prisoner of war is a person wearing a military uniform in a formal army. They cannot be tortured. Well, an insurgent might not be a prisoner of war then, that's true. But if you look at the Fourth Geneva Convention, that covers everybody else. It covers all standard civilians. By standard, I mean women, children, elderly folks, anybody not in a military uniform. It specifically covers insurgents. It specifically uncovers saboteurs and anyone that even carries out acts of deadly force against an occupying army. Does it say you leave them in the streets to come back and kill more people? No. It says you do what we did in the case of the Oklahoma bombers. You pick them up, you bring them to a fair trial, and then you can imprison them. But you cannot torture them. It's very specific on that. You can't torture anyone under the Geneva Conventions. There is no special category that's not covered by the conventions. If that weren't quite enough, we have the Convention Against Torture, which we've signed on to. We're a signatory to that. And it absolutely prohibits the torture of any human being under any circumstances, including specifically situations of extreme security emergencies. No matter how extreme your security crisis, you cannot torture. Not only do we have these two treaties, but we also have two felony statutes in the United States. The first one is the Federal War Crimes Act of 1996. Any major violation of the Geneva Conventions, you get up to 20 years. Torture is a serious part of the Geneva Conventions. There's still another portion. If there was any argument that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply, there's 18 U.S. Code 2340. If a U.S. official tortures or conspires to torture any detainee abroad, they get up to 20 years. Period. Now, what does conspire mean? It means that even if you don't use your own hands to commit the torture, if you do something that makes it easier to carry out the torture of that person or contributes to it, such as sending money, capturing the guy, putting him on an airplane, sending him to Syria, providing the list of questions, standing by, monitoring, etc., then you are guilty just the same, just as someone who pays another person to go shoot his wife so he can get the insurance money. You're guilty of the actual crime that you conspired or contributed to. So actually, our own felony statutes make that prohibited. Why then haven't people at higher levels, such as Rumsfeld, just by way of example, who has signed on to authorizations for many of these torture practices, his signature is on those declassified files, why hasn't he been indicted? Because the person who has to indict him would be Alberto Gonzalez, who wrote the memos. So we have a really serious breakdown of our checks and balances. What we really need is what just happened in the Rove case, for example, the Valerie Plame case, where we get an independent prosecutor. When there's that kind of a breakdown, when there's that kind of a conflict of interest, someone else has to do the investigation. What happens with our international allies if we never do prosecute? They have to prosecute us. They're bound by the Geneva Conventions, too. Either extradite them back where they'll be prosecuted, or they have to prosecute us. So we're putting our allies under terrible strain. We're trying to force them to also violate the Geneva Conventions by simply looking the other way while we carry out these practices. The last issue then, what do we do then? Do we have to allow torture in order to stay safe? And I think that's where many, many of the people that I've spoken to throughout the United States have their deepest concerns. Is it true that torture will somehow keep us safer? Because I think a lot of people feel, well, you know, what if there was, you know, a nuclear bomb under Grand Central Station? Shouldn't we allow torture under extreme circumstances? And I think we have to look at this from several different angles, and I think we should go all the way through the analysis because it is important. If it means that we're going to be safer, that's worthwhile for many people in this country, no matter how abhorrent torture is. Well, first of all, almost all international intelligence experts, including U.S. intelligence experts, agree that when you torture someone, you don't get good intelligence. That's why you can't allow confessions obtained through torture into any trial in the United States, although we're about to do that for the first time. Normally, you cannot allow any such confession in because people will say anything when they're tortured. You don't get good information. You get Niagara Falls. People say everything. There's the classic case of Mr. Aboud, who was first tortured in Iraq in Abu Ghraib by Saddam Hussein. He then got out of prison. The Americans came in. He thought he saw a bomb in a car, reported it to the Iraqi police, who turned him over to the U.S. military forces, who put him back in Abu Ghraib and tortured him again. He had admitted that he was Osama bin Laden in disguise. He knew the drill. Just say what they want to hear. Just say yes to everything and get yourself out of there as fast as you can. He then decided most likely to join the insurgents, unfortunately, after he was released. You don't get specific information. People are hurting. They'll name everyone on the block. You'll pick up everyone on the block, torture them. You'll get everybody in the neighborhood. You won't get the piece of information you're looking for. Perhaps most importantly, if the person really is that high up in a really drastic scheme, such as, again, hypothetically, the huge bomb under Grand Central Station, that's never in fact happened. But if it did happen and the person was that high up, within an hour of his or her capture, the friends that they are working with, their colleagues, will have moved everything. Also, anyone that high up is very carefully trained in the same techniques that our own CIA and other covert operatives are trained, including my husband. the first 48 hours, you say anything but the actual situation while you're being tortured. Well, people can change the codes, they can change the evacuation routes, they can change the plans, they change everything. Again, our own intelligence officials are trained exactly this way. It's basic training. If you torture that person who really might know where the great bomb might be, they're not going to tell you for at least a day or so, and by then everything will be moved. So by the time you get the truth, it's no longer accurate. And of course, you have to worry, I think most importantly, when torture is carried out on a routine basis in many different countries, or if we look at historical examples, when there is a use of what I would call excessive security measures, excessively repressive security measures, that has never resulted in the kind of peace, stability, and security that the government or army that's using those methods has actually been trying to seek. Look, for example, at Northern Ireland, where Britain really cracked down for centuries over there, but centuries have gone by. It's not a stable or peaceful situation. If we look at the French in Algeria, for example, there were many suicide bombers there during the first phase of the revolution there against the colonialists. The French responded with really severe methods, and they did use severe torture techniques. For a while, the bombings went down, but then they expanded greatly, because what happened is the Algerians were outraged by what they were seeing the French do and by the extreme treatment that they were all receiving. They then bonded together as they had not earlier and threw the French out. If we look at Vietnam, that situation did not go very well for us. Mandela is now president, or was elected president of South Africa. You don't get the results you're looking for with this shock and awe technique. You get the reverse of what you're looking for, which is a huge increase in the actual attacks. I was very curious about the situation, for example, with Palestinian suicide bombers in Israel-Palestine, a very personal situation for me since half of my family, in fact, was in the Holocaust. But I went back there and was trying to get a profile on the suicide bombers that would, in fact, include the issue of trauma from excessive security measures being carried out. And I couldn't, of course, from any official, including any officials here in this country, and I know they have this information, I couldn't get anyone to answer those questions. Since it's a fairly obvious issue, I can only think that they do have the answers, but did not wish to share those with the public. So I went over there and got my own information, working with Israeli human rights groups and also with field investigators on the ground. And we found that after the first intifada, depending on how you actually define a suicide bomber, and we defined it as the very classic situation of either a bombing belt or a bomb-filled car, there were about 50. That number is low because it was pretty much a new thing that was being carried out. That hadn't happened very much before. But as the second intifada went on, it was 150, and that was 2 years ago when I went over there. It jumped enormously. We then broke that total number down for the second intifada, and it was all coming out of Gaza. It was all coming out of Jenin. It was all coming out of Nablus, all places where there were notoriously harsh security measures in place. So then we broke it down a little more. We hired Arabic-speaking field workers to go and actually interview the families. The Gaza one couldn't get out of his street, basically, because of the security crackdown, so he wasn't able to carry out the interviews. But we did Jenin, and we did Nablus and Ramallah areas. And out of the 40, all of them showed extreme trauma. The brother shot to death at the door. Friend shot to death in front of the juice shop as a car went by. A woman who was very upset, who had been working for the Red Crescent and carried a friend to the ambulance only to have his brains fall out in her hands. Extreme trauma. What did they get? A tripling of the suicide attacks. The first few weeks of our entry into Iraq, people were throwing flowers at the troops and toppling the statues of Saddam Hussein. What are they doing now? They're throwing bombs up to 50 a day against our troops. Who's paying first for the rage that's been created by our treatment of the detainees, our troops? Most importantly, though, and this is why McCain and all of the military people, including Colin Powell, tried so hard to prevent those memos from going through and being signed off on by the White House that were basically authorizing the use of torture. It was the military that jumped in there first and said, don't do it, don't do it. It'll, number one, totally disgrace our forces, but number two, it'll mostly endanger our troops. Because if we've said that it's not really torture to drown someone or waterboard someone, then our troops can be waterboarded. I mean, it all goes by our definition, right? The great thing about the Geneva Convention is that they're a two-way street. If we don't obey, they don't have to obey. So, you know, this is a really huge concern. Who pays first for the outrage? Our own troops. Who pays first by lowering the bar of the definition of torture? Our own troops. But secondly, my real concern is that as we sow the seeds of hatred and just greatly increase the rage against us and unify the Muslim world against us, are we safer here in this country, or are we greatly increasing the likelihood of another attack? And I think the answer to that is very obvious. So with that, I'd like to just open this for questions, and thank you very much. Yeah.
Do you think racism plays a part in the justification of torture?
Absolutely. I can think of very few situations where people who are not of color have been tortured. For example, even given my background, most of my life, I've never had to even dream that if I were stopped by the police or arrested, which has happened to me quite a few times in front of the White House, that someone would torture me. I mean, that just hardly enters my mind. It just can't be, right? And I realize someday that that might be possible in this country. But a Mexican-American, a Hispanic in this country, an African-American, a Native American, I mean, look at what happened at Pine Ridge. Look what happened in Philadelphia with the On the Move people. Look what happened in the Trail of Tears, the lynchings. Of course a person of color in this country knows that they could end up being tortured. Abner Louima is not that long ago. And what happened in New Orleans just now is not that long ago. It's a few weeks ago. Are Caucasian Anglo-American people ever tortured? I mean, maybe once in a blue moon it happens. I think there was, in fact, an Englishman or an Australian who was at Guantanamo and John Lind, but it's few and far between. Yeah.
If you were addressing these American interrogators who are present at these sites, what could you say to them?
I guess what I'd start with for most of them is sitting down and talking about the security issues, because there are, I think most of them, and I was just leafleting in front of the White House yesterday, in fact, and spoke to one person who was at Guantanamo as an interrogator. What you always hear from that category of folks is, well, they're just as bad as that, and they burned people and strung them up from the bridge, et cetera, et cetera. I think you have to first sit down and talk about, does torture get you good information? Got to balance that against the hatred and rage against the United States. Let's look at all these examples. Let's look at what's actually happened in Iraq compared to the first week with the flowers and looking at it now. And let's really evaluate this. A lot of people ask me when I give this talk, well, if torture doesn't work, how do you get good information? And because the FBI and the police have to work within the constraints of the Constitution in this country, the CIA does not. They work outside the United States, so they're not under that kind of limitation. They also can't be court-martialed because they're not military, they're civilians. But the FBI and the police force in this country have worked out a lot of ways over the two centuries that they tell us is far more effective. And in fact, our intelligence officials say the same thing, our experts, and that's building a rapport, incentives and disincentives, intensive investigation so that you're constantly cross-examining the person over and over again till you find the contradictions and confront them with it. Good cop, bad cop, stealth. You tell a person that his colleague or his partner has already confessed to everything, so he might as well talk too. All of those ways where you don't actually lay hands on the person has worked better. And a number of Middle Eastern intelligence experts are now saying, don't send an American in at all. It's the worst thing you could do. Send in a religious leader, an imam. Let him talk to the prisoner. Let him build a rapport with him and convince him that this is not the way. This is not the way in Islam. And I think that makes a whole lot of sense. Those are the kinds of things I would start with people in Guantanamo. Yeah.
What happens to the torturer in their mind? They lose their humanity.
There's sort of different categories, and I would have to base this on what I've seen in Guatemala. There are always born psychos that gravitate towards the position of torturers, but let's put them aside. Many young Mayan people were forcibly recruited into the Guatemalan military when they were 14 years old. I'll use a specific example. This young person was recruited, literally dragged off a soccer field and put into the army, didn't have money to buy his way out, was beaten into learning Spanish and following orders in boot camp. And on his very first combat duty, they faced an ambush. And the sergeant was very angry and marched into the village, grabbed another 15-year-old and dragged him out, tied him to a tree and took his shoes off and made everyone line up and burn his feet with flaming branches. And the young soldier got to the front and he spoke the same language. They were both Sutuil speakers, I think. And he was trying to tell the sergeant, he doesn't know what you're saying. He can't understand your language. He doesn't speak Spanish. And he got to the front, having got nowhere, and said, look, I can't burn his feet. He doesn't even know what you're saying. And the sergeant said, then take your shoes off and sit next to him. So the soldier burned the kid's feet and then just started going crazy after that. And then the next combat, he pulled his clothes off and played dead in the middle of a combat field. they left him, he ran naked into a nearby village of Sutuil speakers and said, just get me out of here. They took him to a church, and the church people came and got me, thinking that I would help him get out through sanctuary, which when I first heard the story, I wasn't very interested. But finally went over there, and he had gone completely mad in a church basement. He was barking like a dog. Most people, after the first time, they say, you know, you just get a wall up, you get sort of anesthetized by it, and you can do it. The problem is after the war, when the wall comes back down. I have talked to someone that I'm pretty sure was in the group that killed my husband. He's very young, had a child, was completely flipped out, couldn't tell me what happened, cried hysterically, was on the verge of either fainting or throwing up, and ended up in a mental institution, so I still don't have a story. And there's a lot of people that ended up like that. Most of the young Mayans went home, and the whole community would really gravitate around them because everyone had the same experience. No one went voluntarily. And really, it's sort of no questions asked. They just took everyone back. Then there are those people whose walls stay up and are sort of permanent psychopaths. And I'll just say that there's been a wave of killing of young women in Guatemala where not only are they raped and killed, they're hideously mutilated, exactly the same way that death squad victims, where their hands are sawed off, they're hacked, I won't tell you, just grisly killings. And that the last year, I think, has a higher number of victims like that than Juarez in the last 10 years. So people pick up very nasty habits when those walls don't come down. So it's horrifying for all of those people. Yeah.
When the New Nuremberg trials start, it will definitely commence one day. It should be somewhere.
For the Latin Americans and Central Americans, those 23 cases, those are documented in my book, and a lot of them I do pseudonyms, but I do have their files. More people are contacting me saying, well, that happened to me too, which is very interesting. And I'm working now on trying to get some of those old archives out of Vietnam as well with the same techniques. But it's something we do need to work on. And I agree, there have to be the equivalent of Nuremberg trials, which means we're not going to put on trial every Lindy England in the military. That's pretty silly. Not that people shouldn't go to prison if they follow orders that they know were illegal. That, by the way, came out of Nuremberg as well, which is why those young MPs are in prison. It's not a legal defense to say I was following orders if it's an issue like torture or something that is just so outrageous they should have known better. But in the end, it's unfair. They clearly were following orders. Those techniques have been around forever, exactly those techniques. In fact, that photograph of the hooded man on the box with the wires hanging off his hands from Abu Ghraib, that's called the Vietnam position in intelligence circles. I mean, it does go all the way back. So to put her in prison, well, all right, you know, she did break the law, but to put her in prison and not Rumsfeld, whose signature is on these lists, that's outrageous. He personally authorized and signed off on most of those techniques, then rescinded the authorization, but said, if you need to use those in a specific case, just ask me for authorization. In other words, still authorized. Yeah.
How did it start?
There's probably a whole lot of reasons and ways that began.
It started in the days of the Dulles brothers.
Well, the Dulles brothers that did the 1954 coup in Guatemala, of course, which ousted the first reformist, popularly elected president they'd ever had and plunged the country into a 35-year war that the UN declared genocide at the end. I think with regard to those specific torture techniques, the CIA was founded when? Just after World War II. I think they've been working on those exact kinds of practices and refining them, working them more and more ever since then, because everywhere the CIA went at that point, the beginnings of those practices can be seen everywhere, and you see them repeated everywhere the CIA ended up ever since, such as Guatemala. The death squads, of course, there too. In fact, when they started the death squad equivalent, the Scorpio unit in Iraq, they were talking about, quote, the Salvadorization option in Iraq. They even used those words. Yeah.
I have a question on the petition to World Court, but short of that, I wonder if you also thought about either pursuing a truth and reconciliation, a people's congress.
We definitely want to see some kind of tribunal. We'll hear these cases, a really formal court tribunal. Now, the problem is the World Court, we lost to Nicaragua over the mining of their harbors back in the 80s, right? They took us to the World Court. We lost. We laughed it off. I mean, we just don't take it seriously. We won't subject ourselves to the Inter-American Court of the OAS, which is in Costa Rica, and where I won a 100-page decision against the Guatemalan military, by the way, on the grounds that no human being can be tortured, not even a leader in the guerrilla units, under any circumstances. I wish Bush would read that opinion. We're not part of that, and we've refused, obviously, to join the International Criminal Court. And in fact, we're pressuring many countries throughout Latin America, saying we will cut off all of their economic aid, in fact, destroy their economy, in other words, if they don't sign what's called bilateral immunity agreements, that they will never help bring any kind of case against us. In the end, we have to force through some indictments here. Otherwise, our European allies will be forced to do so. And I noticed that already, because of the announcement that came out in Dana Priest's article, that some Eastern European countries were the locations of secret prisons for CIA ghost prisoners, already the European Union is saying, well, that would violate our laws over here. We have to look into this. Italy's already indicted more than 20 CIA people. Germany is investigating. Sweden is investigating. Spain is bringing charges on the basis of the killings of some of their reporters. Our allies don't want to break with us yet. It's going that direction unless we bring indictments here. And I think that's got to be the next thing we start working on. For anyone that wants to, we did a mock trial, and some 600 Unitarians did show up in Washington on September 24th. And it's on our website if you'd like to watch. Real survivors came and did speak. It was sort of our first step that direction. It was quite amazing. Yes?
How do we ever reach people who have been brainwashed by Rush Limbaugh and Fox News to think that because they do it, it's okay for us to do it?
What McCain said lately, I think, makes a lot of sense. It's not about who they are, it's about who we are, number one. For some people, that's not going to be enough. If they're that bad, then we have to be that bad. And then I think, again, we sit down and just go through it bit by bit. You don't get good intelligence. It pretty much corrupts and corrodes out our own troops. How many of us would raise our kids to be Lindy England if we had a choice, right? How many of us would want to see a photograph of a son or daughter in that position with a dog leash? I don't think anybody. Also, just go through the security steps just very slowly and bit by bit. Like, you know, what happens when you do that? You don't get the good intelligence. If you do get the intelligence, it doesn't last because they probably wouldn't have had that much in the first place. And by then, you've probably created a half a dozen new suicide bombers. Isn't there some other way to really go about this? And talk about the other methods that FBI and police have worked out over the years and the fact that those do work better, in fact. And very interesting, there's a case out of the Philippines. Bojinka, I think, is the name of the article, but it was many years ago. A Filipina woman police officer heard a puff of an explosion down the street from her office, and she was just going off duty. And someone called over and said it turned out to be nothing. Someone had an accident in the kitchen or a firecracker went off. But the Pope was about to visit, and she just had this intuition that she should go look. So she goes over there and sees this young man running out of the apartment building, throwing his clothes on and running as fast as he can. So she just goes in and looks and finds this huge cache of explosives. No wonder they were running. And they capture one person on the street, and the other person gets away. And just by going through the apartment, they find all this information, not only to assassinate the Pope, but to bomb three different airliners. They get the names, they get everything off the computer, and it was just her intuition. That one person they then take to prison and torture for 67 days, during which time he also says, and one of the planes was supposed to hit the Pentagon, a small aircraft was going to be loaded up with bombs and go after a U.S. target. But in those 67 days, obviously it wasn't about to imminently happen because it took 67 days to get that information out of him, would we have got more information using other techniques? And also, almost all of the information that we needed was obtained just by good police work over there. That policewoman now is very, very bitter because she feels like she gave the United States all that information and they still didn't act correctly in terms of getting all the intelligence together and preventing that kind of an attack. So I think that case really has a lot of aspects that clarify some of those issues. Yeah.
Why are there so few of us that are as outraged as I am? Also, find out about going through early basic training and you'll find out that we were all taught to be really pissed off at anything and to support our buddies. But why, in this wonderful nation of Grandma Moses paintings, we have allowed outsourcing torture?
I think most people in the United States, and I have been going crisscrossing the U.S. over and over again for a year and a half now, and even in an audience where a third of the people, if not two-thirds, were Bush supporters, I've heard them all say the same thing. I did vote for Bush. I didn't vote for torture. That's just going too far. I think a lot of people are legitimately fearful of another attack. And I think, you know, it's complicated issues. Intuitively, you think, well, he won't tell me, so I better beat it out of him. And that's just sort of a gut reaction. It doesn't work. It's just something where you've got to go through step by step of the analysis. Like, for example, you want to protect your good buddy, so You mess up with that prisoner, your good buddy's going to have his head cut off, like Nick Berg. They said they cut his head off because of what they saw in the Abu Ghraib photographs. It was retaliation specifically for that. And I think we just have to start dealing with those issues, but it takes a while. It takes a lengthy discussion, and you have to be able to get along well enough for an hour to get that kind of conversation going. And I did that yesterday, again, in front of the White House. It was very interesting with two Vietnam vets. Yes?
The whole question of rounding up people indiscriminately and classifying them as enemy combatants. You're imprisoning people. You have no idea whether they have done anything or not. It doesn't matter.
And it is very sad. Most of the people in Guantanamo are on a hunger strike now. They're reaching critical conditions.
Force-fed, which is torture.
It's related to what you just said. A lot of them, because they were just grabbed off the streets and ended up in Guantanamo, they've had no hearings, and they just feel like on the edge of despair. The Koran's been stamped on. They have no rights. They have no hearing. There's no way to know if they'll ever get out of there. Maybe they'll spend the rest of their life there. Many of them have been tortured. They're on a hunger strike for two reasons. The Supreme Court said they had to have access to the courts, and they don't have any yet. They haven't been obeyed. And they don't want to be tortured anymore. So there were sporadic hunger strikes and suicide attempts since people came to Guantanamo. There have been many, many suicide attempts. But also, over the summer, they started up again over the extreme beatings that people are getting and the extreme isolation and outright torture that a lot of them are still dealing with. Legislatures, our congresspeople, were not allowed into those parts of the camp. They were only allowed into the sort of model prisoner area, where none of that was happening. Camp 5 is the most serious area, and they've never spoken to anyone. And the last month, they all went on it. It spread to more than 200 of them. Many are reaching critical condition. They started force-feeding some of them, literally stuffing the feeding tubes through their nose, down their throat with no anesthesia. In a couple of cases, they've ripped the feeding tube out of one prisoner and forced it down the other's throat without cleaning it off. It's covered with blood and stuff. So even that has become a torture technique. We're asking everyone to please call your congresspeople, if all of you could do that, both your senator and your rep, and just say you want an immediate investigation, no forced feedings, and an immediate investigation into the torture practices there, that you find that hunger strike to be valid. Needless to say, this strikes a chord for me, because day 30 in front of the National Palace in Guatemala, I had said, hunger strike to the death, give me back my husband or take me with him, right? My hair was falling out. I had a heart murmur. You know, I was cold all the time. My blood sugar was down to coma level. I do remember being dragged up a back stairway to visit with the Minister of Defense, who told me, you know, if you keep this up, I'm going to strap you down to a table in the best hospital in Guatemala City because I respect you so much and I'm going to make you take nutrition. And I said, you can't do that. You can't, like, stop me from trying to save my husband's life. You can't make me stop demanding an end to torture. That would be an assault. So what are we doing? And I remember, too, when I was in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, right after all those disclosures by Senator Torricelli, I gave my whole testimony, and the whole panel said, this is an outrage that someone would have to go on a hunger strike to the death over an issue like torture. This just can't be. And it'll never happen again. So, you know, we really need to pick up on this, and there's very little press coverage. We need to force this issue. Yes?
Do you see any presidential candidate on the horizon that and some chance of winning that would turn all of it around?
I'm very worried about that. I don't know who has the ability to turn it around and also has a chance of winning. I don't know if Howard Dean, for example, would have a chance of winning. I think he would turn that around by brute force. But I'm not sure if those two things can go hand in hand. I'm very worried about it. Yeah?
I've heard a lot of talk about psychological torture, where investigators will lock a detainee in a room and either play excruciatingly loud music or would play recordings of people screaming.
And say it's their wife. And they've done other things. Like, I know Khaled, Sheikh Khaled, it says that it's been repeated several times in different places like the New York Times and the Post and stuff. His elementary school-age children are, quote, within access of U.S. military, unquote. What does that mean? And another one, an Iraqi general apparently finally broke after they took his young son, maybe 14 years old, stripped him in the cold, covered him with mud and water, and then waited till he was shivering uncontrollably, and then put him in front of a two-way window so that the father could watch. We're going after their kids. There's kids in Guantanamo. And it's like, we do things like that all the time. That is totally illegal. Psychological torture is as much of a felony as physical torture is, and that statute specifically lists threatening to kill or torture a family member. The felony statute here in this country, we don't even have to look at our treaties. The felony statute has physical torture is anything that inflicts severe pain. Mental torture includes going after family members and any kind of technique or substance, drug or otherwise, but also any technique that causes a mental break. And a lot of people think, well, you know, you scared them to death by pulling a trigger to their head, right, and thinking they were going to die, or holding them in the pit, for example. But they got over it. But the truth is, no torture survivor ever gets over torture. You know, I lived with Sister Diana Ortiz for years. Her arms would be black and blue from flailing against the walls all night long when she was having nightmares and stuff. Suicide rate amongst survivors is very, very high. People don't really survive any kind of torture. And that's why it's every bit as much of a felony as the physical torture is. That's not just out of coincidence.
If we knew what the origin of the desire to torture others, would we be able to then have a remedy?
I'm sure a lot of you have also read the psychiatric experiments that have been done over the years, and those terrify me because the bottom line seems to be that all of us are probably able to be torturers if our socialization layers are stripped off, as in boot camp, when all of that is pretty much taught, right? You just forget everything except following orders, and you go to boot camp to learn how to kill, right? The one done at Yale right after World War II, they would literally have an actor be the person on a table with electrical wires attached to their limbs. And behind a glass, the volunteer would have the needle to turn the voltage up, and it was supposed to be a learning experiment. And the person running the experiment was the teacher. And every time the person answered a question wrong, they were supposed to get a little bit of a shock. And what they found is, as long as the teacher said, turn it way, way up, the person almost always, at least two-thirds of the time, would turn the needle way up, even with the person on the bed screaming and writhing in agony and saying, no, don't do it anymore. I don't want to be part of the experiment anymore. The first time they stopped the psychological experiment, and the other people in the department said, that's because you've got all these alpha male Yale students. That's not normal society. So they tried it with a cross-section of New Haven people and found exactly the same results. And as many times as it's been repeated, they get the same results. The other one that's really horrifying to me is the one out of Stanford, where they got a number of student volunteers, have to be prison guards and have to be prisoners. And they were going to carry that out for a month and stopped after 10 days on ethical grounds because, quote, the students were developing creative cruelty who were in the roles of the guards. And they repeated that over and over again. And basically, if you have prisoners and guards, you get tortured. Even the military, in reporting back at the end of its investigation, that if you strip a prisoner naked or otherwise dehumanize them, it's 10 times more likely that the guard is going to torture him or her. In other words, the less the person looks dignified, the more likely we are to start using torture on that person. So I'm afraid, having watched it happen to my father's family and then watching it in Guatemala and watching us do it now, I don't think it's color, class, or anything else. I think we all have that wiring and that we have to socialize ourselves enough that no one ever can push that button within us.
So do we know the origin of the desire to torture people?
I don't know. I think it goes back to the caves. I think it goes back to the idea that a big stick is what keeps you safe, and it doesn't anymore. And I think what one intelligence person said was very interesting on why we're torturing. He said, if you actually have to torture a prisoner, it's because you already, like, totally blew it, right? It means you already got the message at the White House that Al-Qaeda plans to attack within the United States immediately, and you didn't do anything about it. He says the reason that most people end up torturing a prisoner is because they already blew it, and they're afraid and frustrated, and they're just punishing the person. In Guatemala, it was used also to get the whole population to get down and not resist anymore. If you resist, we'll kill your child, which I was just there in January. They strangled a baby when they couldn't find the parents at home that were two indigenous leaders in Chimaltenango. To an extent, we're doing that in Iraq also. It's just that we ought to learn from history. Again, you know, you can get everybody to get down and stop resisting short term, but in Guatemala, people are already talking about going back to war. It hasn't been 10 years. You can get people down for a minute, but you can't keep them down with that kind of a stick. Yeah.
A lot of people ask, how could Germany announce what happened, what happened in Nazi Germany? What can we do? How can we not let the same thing happen? Because, I mean, the torture has been happening down in Chile and Argentina and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Honduras, and we're the ones who've been behind it.
I think the bottom line throughout all of these talks is everyone wants to do something, but there's this sense that the government's too big and we can't make it happen. And I think that we can. I really think that we can. It means massive work. I think we have to start with Congress, because what I keep hearing from our reps and our senators is, yeah, we'll take action on it, but are you guys going to back us up or not? Are we going to get thrown out of office for being soft on terror? And they need to hear a lot more from us. And I think we need to get real specific on war crimes trials. I think only when someone at the top finally goes to prison for the last 50 years worth of exporting torture are we going to get it to stop. Because it's gone on 50 years and it's never happened, I think that's why it's still happening. So I think we've got to be willing to really, really unify and go after it. And watch our website. We will be taking action. The Unitarians is www.UUSC, Unitarian Universalist Service Committee.org. Go to Stop Torture. Yes.
Can you tell me some of the actions of the Stop Torture campaign?
We just did our main event for the last 6 months that we had been building up to. We carried out people's indictments all summer long for Rumsfeld, Tenet, and Gonzalez. And the different aspects of the torture issue that I've been discussing tonight, we actually did a 7-hour mock trial in Washington, D.C., to which 600 people came and listened for the whole 6 or 7 hours and then went to the Congress the next day in a massive lobbying session. What I think the first step is to build coalitions right here, everybody in their home area, build coalitions and do this piece of grassroots organizing by teaching all of these issues, by going through the security stuff, by dealing with the enemy combatant issue. That's what that book is. It's a huge toolbox. I just put everything in that I knew so that everybody could have equal access to that information, the legal issues, the security issues, and everything, you know, the quotes from the intelligence officials. There's about 800 footnotes in that book. But start just with the groundwork here so that we have big enough coalitions. And that means with groups that otherwise in other situations might not be that similar to us. But build huge coalitions and then start joining us. We'll be working on the Guantanamo case. We've got urgent actions out right now on the McCain case. We're working right now with the different legal groups to figure out maybe ways of dealing with the indictment issue. So probably in the next month or two, we'll have a coalition going to work on the whole question of how to get an independent prosecutor in there. There's not a statute requiring it anymore. But Fitzgerald happened. It's like if he could go after Roe, then we can move on this one.
Do you see anything on the horizon, like any groups with young people can get involved and, you know, take action?
Absolutely. I mean, Amnesty has chapters on almost every campus, and we're working in close coalition with them, for example. And, you know, I'm working with Amnesty through the UUSC, also Deanna Ortiz's organization for torture survivors from around the world. We're in close touch with and often work with Pax Christi and the Mary Knollers and Rabbis for Human Rights and so on and so forth. You're going to see on any of our websites is stuff that we're all doing together. If you could just link into that, that would be really good. Yeah. The question was when Inez Murillo was tortured in Honduras, was Ambassador Negroponte there? I was like, sure was. During the height of the Battalion 316 murders and disappearances, Negroponte was ambassador. People were pouring into his embassy begging for help, and he was reporting back to Congress that there were no violations going on. And there's a really amazing layout of what his report said and what was going on, and the case is happening like there's no attacks on the journalists. These 10 journalists died that year in the Baltimore Sun article called Unearthed Secrets. It's a great article. It came out in 96, I believe, either 95 or 96, by Gary Cohn, C-O-H-N. Yeah.
One of the problems is that many of the people who are in policy-making positions in our government right now are people who were investigated, were convicted during Iran-Contra, were pardoned, and they feel that they can be pardoned again and do it as many times as they want.
Yeah, Terry Ward got fired over Everardo's case, but he's definitely back in favor and has gotten several prizes. Elliot Abrams, Oliver North, Negroponte. It's like the evil Jack in the Box. We finally kicked those guys out at the end of the Central America Wars, and they're all back. The people in my case in the State Department also that told the intelligence committees, both the House and Senate, for 2.5 years that there was no information, they in fact knew where my husband was and who was detaining him as of 6 days after his capture. And the files show what was happening to him for those 2.5 years and the fact that 350 other prisoners were having the same treatment. After they're all dead, then the 60 Minutes bulletin came out. All of those people that were involved in the State Department, they're now like ambassadors to Guatemala, Salvador, Colombia. The very worst out of that era is back at the top. Maybe next time we should figure out how to not get them pardoned. Yeah.
What do you see in the future for the International Criminal Court? Clearly, we need to be part of that. Do you see any possibility of moving in that direction?
Yeah, you know, Clinton had signed us into the International Criminal Court, and I'm not even sure it's legally valid that Bush took us back out. That's one of those gray zones. And I think a lot of this has to be done legally, but I think Congress could do a lot of it. I think we have to force Congress to send us through somehow to the court. And I'm not sure procedurally how that would work, mechanically how that would work, but I think that's one thing we should think of. I think there's a whole lot we can do through the U.S. Congress that we haven't done yet. Like I say, in so many audiences where I speak, people have been hesitant to do something because it's really complicated and they weren't sure what the Geneva Conventions did say and what about the security issues. They just wanted to know that they weren't going to look foolish if they move forward. So again, what we got to do is start with grassroots organization and intensive educational stuff. If you want our trial, our mock trial, which we put on to exactly illustrate all of these points, like we went up to Mr. Rumsfeld, who was David Clennon, who played the CIA guy in the movie Missing, for example, and said, well, that's what the third Geneva Convention says. Let us hand you the fourth Geneva Convention. Would you read this aloud to the jury? All the stuff I covered tonight, we did sort of through theater. And it was very effective. If you want that as a tool, that could be one series of things you could do, for example. You can bring in speakers. But I think the first thing is to get as huge a group as you can together and then go to Congress. You can go to the local offices. You can bombard them with phone calls. We're going to have first Monday of the month national phone call sessions to Congress. Watch our website for that, where everybody in the United States calls the first Monday of every month. Call every day if you want, but at least call the first Monday. Those kinds of things. My proposal is we start putting everyone in jail under war crimes tribunals. And then if someone really does, if there really was someday a nuclear weapon under Grand Central Station, 29 million lives were somehow saved because they tortured the person, and amazingly enough, they did say where the bomb was, and they were able to save the world. Frankly, that's never going to happen. It's like saying 1 and 1 is 3. But if someday 1 and 1 does equal 3, that's what we have presidential pardons for. That's why there's discretion in sentencing. And that person is not going to end up in prison. We don't need to legalize torture. The Israeli army went through this with the Israeli Supreme Court, and I think that whole history is really worth our looking at also. Originally, the Israeli Supreme Court with the Landau Commission said if there's going to be an imminent attack, you can use moderate physical force, which probably a lot of people would propose today here. By 1990, their own civil rights organizations went back to the Supreme Court with very careful documentation that I think 85% of the Palestinian prisoners were being tortured under U.S. standards. And the Supreme Court then decided it would never be legal. They did have a footnote in there that there was some dire circumstances you can come in and hopefully you won't get as harshly sentenced, but it is illegal. And what they wrote, I think, is very moving. They said, it may be that a democracy must fight with one hand behind its back, but at least it is the upper hand. Now, if Israel can figure that out with imminent bombings almost every day, I think we should be able to figure it out. And again, just as they found that the torture of the prisoners skyrocketed when they allowed any elasticity like that, so did the suicide attacks skyrocket just as well. And the problem is, once you say if it's an imminent attack, you can use moderate force, well, all right, does how imminent? An hour from now, next week, next month? How big an attack? Nuclear bomb, small bomb? Does it have to be in a civil society? What if it's just there might be an attack down the road next week of against our troops? Could we torture the person then? Can we torture him? Do we, or could we torture his wife? How about his kids? What about the neighbor down the street? There's no way to hold the line once you start. Yeah.
Congress people do live now. I mean, it was the press that told us about the shell prison.
Well, the problem is they're secret so that they can hurt people. Waxman had called for an investigative commission, like for a full investigation of the torture stuff, and in all the uproar over McCain's amendment, which we should push for because otherwise Cheney's going to try to legalize torture. And I hate to think that we're at that state where it could actually be legalized, but we have to go full out to insist that McCain's statement not be watered down and that it does go through. That's a huge issue. But more important than just saying you're not allowed to torture, which we already aren't allowed to do. It's already illegal, like I say. But more important even, we need to not forget about the investigative commissions. We really need to push for that. And Waxman has pushed for that. The extraordinary renditions when we send them to other countries to be tortured over there, Syria and Egypt. Markey on the House side has a bill out for that, and Leahy has one against it over in the Senate. So we need to keep pushing for all of those bills. I mean, there's beginnings on the Hill now, and I'm really glad to see that. So if you can all make calls on that, the calls do add up. They really do.
When we say goodbye, I would like to just say that Jennifer's book is very readable. Tons of information in it we all need to know. And I want to thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being here.
Thank you.